session number 11073, reel 3.
Mr. Parr, reel 3.
Having stopped, it was time to serve Christmas dinner. We got out of the 3-ton trucks and the towable was lowered and then hooked up with the chains, and dinner was served. It was served by Sergeant Bob Ollis, and we all crowded round. This time we were really getting hungry. It consisted of a loaf of bread and a tin of salmon. There were 30 of us, and we watched very, very closely as he cut slice after slice, then cut the slices in half and arranged them on the towel board until they numbered 30. The tin of salmon was opened, put in a Dixie and mashed up with a fork, and it was a half a forkful of salmon on each half slice of dry bread. And that was my Christmas dinner, 1944, down in the Ardennes. They did promise us later on we would get a real Christmas dinner. We did eventually get some food, but the trouble was they shot the entire the entire 10,000 of the 6th Airborne Division out to the Ardennes to help in the Battle of the Bulge, fully armed and equipped, but with no food whatsoever, but with instructions to live off the land. We arrived at Givet on Boxing Day. We'd been 22 hours on the road. We were billeted in some sort of chapel come schoolroom. Givet was absolutely up to here in snow. There was no food forthcoming. We eventually got some sort of rations. My experience of the Ardennes was not battle. It was sheer endurance. Sheer endurance. It was so cold down there that you had to oil and re-oil your rifles and brain guns twice a day because the oil was freezing. The temperature was so low it was unbelievable. Within my battalion of Cinknocks and Butts, the only real action fought down there was C Company in the Battle of Bure, where they lost many men. We were rushed up to reinforcements to reinforce them, but it was over by the time we got there. As a matter of fact, the whole Battle of the Bulge had petered out by the time we got there. We were all ready to go into action, but the line had straightened up and the Germans had been pushed back. We stayed down there approximately some 6 to 8 weeks, and it was persistent, consistent patrol activity in frozen snow. We used to come back off a patrol. We used to go out on patrols in all our clothes, obviously, and with sandbags full of straw encasing our feet. Any Germans that had found our tracks must have thought we were using elephants for patrols. But it was the sheer blinding cold of the place that got you. Literally, if you put your finger on a bit of metal or a weapon of some sort and kept it there for any length of time, you took it off, you had a burn there. It was that damn cold. We left the area of, I'm trying to think now of the names of some of the places, but there were small villages and places like that down there. And we moved back up onto the Meuse, just this side of Venlo, below the Reichwald Forest. And there we did a patrol activity, as it's called. The Meuse at that point was about a half a mile wide, flowing from south to north, but most of it was ice floes, and this is the truth. Great big lumps of ice were beginning to break up and float up the Meuse. I went on one patrol there. It was led by Captain Phil Bordinay, a Canadian who was in our outfit, and a Sergeant Bob Boulder, who'd now been promoted to Sergeant. And we took a boat over. On our first attempt, it came back on the same bank. The current was that strong. We went out again, and we dumped them, and they were to do patrol activity, the two of them, to see what sort of transport was going up the roads on that side. I had to take the boat back. I ploughed it across the river with the help of some lusty fellas, managed to finally get it back. They were to flash a torch, we were to flash a torch, and that was our signal to pick them up. The night wore on. I reported into Major Ballard's company, B Company, to let him know that the patrol had been out. Unfortunately, he didn't even know that there had one been out. We waited, but we never saw any flashlights. I never saw Claude Gobold or Phil Borden again until I returned to Palestine from India in 1945. Apparently, they decided not to flash the torches in case they were spotted by Germans, and the answering flash might have given away everything and we could have been killed. So in the middle of all that ice and snow, those two men, Captain Phil Bordenay and Sergeant Dobbo, decided to swim through the ice and get back. They tried three times and were eventually exhausted, swept back to the other side, and were picked up and taken prisoner of war. When I came back from India to Palestine, my first stop was a place called Rezalin, and as I jumped off at the back of their truck, who was standing in front of me but Sergeant Claude Gobold. I just looked at him and said, "Hello, Claude." He said, "Hello, Wally." I said, "You took a bloody long time getting back from that trip, didn't you?" And he told me his story. Now, it was more for us a matter of endurance down there. We spent some time on the Meuse doing these various patrol activities, but for some reason, and I don't care who hears me say this, certain powers that be decided that a 6-hour listening patrols would be a good idea. And so as a corporal at that time, I used to have to take the patrol down, among others, obviously, from 6 in the evening till midnight. Somebody else took over from midnight to 6 in the bloody morning. And just laying encased in gas capes, silently in the snow, watching the River Meuse. It was one of the most horrible experiences I've ever had. I used to have to go along the men, touching them, and their gas capes literally cracked with the cold, and making sure they weren't frozen solid or stiff. I'm afraid this only kept up for about a week. Nobody could actually stand it anymore. And although, and I don't give a damn who hears it or knows it, anybody that thought up that damned idea must have been an idiot. 2 hours enough would have been enough for anybody in charge of patrols. We eventually withdrew to the comfort of empty houses in the nearby, and took up our positions from there, which was the most sensible thing. At least you could keep more or less warm there, even if you were still freezing. But that was the worst experience I'd had of conditions. Lying there for 6 hours, from 6 in the evening to midnight, or midnight to 6 in the morning. Absolutely stupid.
What's your own story about the Rhine Crossing?
Well, the Rhine Crossing was the last great airborne battle of the war. Just previous to this, in September of 1944, the 1st Airborne Division had been practically wiped out at Arnhem. I was on leave when it appeared that down in the south the Germans had crossed the Rhine, so we thought, well, that's fair enough. But that wasn't where, I beg your pardon, the Americans had crossed the Rhine, but that wasn't where they wanted it. They wanted to go over north to get to the industrial Ruhr. That's what they were after. In actual fact, they crossed, a company of Americans had crossed a bridge that hadn't been blown down near Cologne. But they were told to stay where they were. It was the wrong place. We were on leave at the time, and then we came back, and we soon realised there was another job coming. We were all kitted out, full equipment, everything, as we always were, but then we knew there was something special. We were taken to airfields north of London. I know the airfield I was on was very near Colchester. But again, we were put in what we called concentration camps, the usual barbed wire, no allowed out. On the 24th of March, we took off. We were up very early in the morning. It was a daylight operation, this one. We had an escort of 500 fighters as the 6th Airborne Division took off for the Rhine Crossing. We all knew what it was. Our particular target, the Ochsenbachs, was to land in the area of Hamilcown, and then capture Hamilcown, lay siege to the Orchard Barn, cut it, and the railway sidings, and above all, try to lay siege to Ringenberg on the other side. We took off in our usual fashion, singing and laughing, but it was a very comforting thought to see all these fighters about. We also understood that we were going to be joined over Brussels in the air by General Ridgway's 17th Airborne Division. They were taken off from France. Ridgway was in charge of the operation. I think Windy Gale was second in command, and Bowles was general command in the 6th Airborne Division. The flight across was quite uneventful. It was just a quiet, steady trip. There was no problems whatsoever. We got over the Belgian coast and carried on, going and going, and just getting closer and closer. Then we realised we joined up with the others. It's all you could see every time you looked out of a hole was gliders and Paris planes, with the Paris, as usual, with the doors open, hanging their legs out and waving. But you know, we got a message before we took off. In the heat of battle, and if visibility is not too good, the German airborne, the German helmet and the British airborne helmet are very much the same shape. And sometimes you have to look twice before you know exactly what to shoot. So one of the para battalions sent out a message to whom it may concern. When we land, we're throwing our helmets away and we're putting on our red berets and we're going to shoot anybody we see wearing a helmet. We all got the message. So we had our red berets tucked inside our smocks. We crossed the Rhine and we all looked out at it, and we all gave a cheer. We finally crossed the Rhine. Just after we crossed the Rhine, somebody nudged me and says, take a look out there. And there's these nasty black puffs. Fleck. The Paras were to drop 3 miles over the Rhine. The gliders were to go on another 3 miles and come down 6 miles. That consisted of the Devons, the Oxenbucks and the Ulsters. And the Fleck got closer and closer. They had sent fighters in to mop up all the anti-aircraft fire that might be coming. Montgomery had been laying a smokescreen across the Rhine for days, burning barrels of oil. They started across at 2 a.m. in the morning, prior to the 24th, and they put out the barrels of oil. Unfortunately, the smoke dropped all over the place. It covered for miles inland, and the wind dropped at the same time. And when the fighters came in, they couldn't find the anti-aircraft guns that was firing. The first wave of our battalion went in, and the powers that be decided to send in the heavy stuff first in the handle cars. This consisted of the 6-pounders, the jeeps and the ammunition. I think the first wave was practically shot out of the air at point blank range. We were introduced to our 2 glider pilots up on the airdrome. And we just looked at them. The old man out of the 2 was 19 years of age, and his co-pilot was 18. They're brand new army uniforms. They belonged to an outfit that was known as the RAF unit. They wore khaki but RAF insignia. I haven't quite got the name correct there, but they were
the RAF regiment.
The RAF regiment, thank you. That's it, the RAF regiment. It was their first experience in action. They did not instill us with confidence, I can assure you. But I wish I could meet them two again. The flak came up. Again, I was in charge of the back door, and I looked down, and as I looked down, all I could see was fire. Burning gliders, burning buildings, and smoke everywhere. An anti-aircraft fire coming up. And those two fellas, they flew that glider straight down. Straight across a field, over another hedge, over another field, and stopped it 60 yards short of a wood. It wasn't a very good landing, but it was the best they could do. And when we recovered from the shock, we whipped off our helmets, put on our red berets, and I immediately saw where we were. The railway sidings were over on our left. I jumped out with my section. This time I was a corporal again. I jumped out with my section. We spread out 5 yards apart and I said, right, go. There's a hedgerow over there. That's all you wanted. We went for it. We ran like hell across this field. There was machine gun fire coming from all directions. You couldn't tell exactly where it was coming from. And we got in the hedge and threw ourselves down, turned round, looked for Lieutenant Shaw and the rest of the platoon. I'm afraid he'd taken the least line of resistance. He went straight into the woods 50 yards in front of him. And that's the last I saw of him for the best part of that day. I was alone with a section. Right, let's take stock. And as we lay there taking stock and me weighing up the situation, we watched the glider come in behind us. The glider came in, it hit the ground and started to bounce across the ground. To our left, over here, was a very large building of 3 or 4 stories, and we could see the glider going like mad towards it. Going like mad, 90 miles an hour, but it seemed now in slow motion. And somebody behind me said, lift it, mate, lift it, lift it. It was too late. It went straight into the middle of the building. The building collapsed on top of it. There was muffled explosions. In the 21st General Hospital, some days later, I spoke to Sergeant Slap Rayner out of D Company, who'd also been wounded later. And he said it was the worst experience he'd had. It was 22 platoon. 30 bodies, more mangled up in there, not one of them survived. From there I decided to make myself over this next field to the railway embankment. We spread out and we charged across the field. I say charge, steady trot. Got to the railway embankment and there we felt a little safer. We ducked underneath these big railway trucks, they was everywhere. Ducked underneath, and then there was an MG-42 coming from over there, rifle fire from over there. Billy Gray was bringing gun. I said, right, Billy, get up in his truck, take him on. He said, right. His number two grabbed hold of the gun. Billy jumped up into the truck above me. His number two started to hand the gun. Billy jumped down and he crouched in front of me, and it was his face. He said, well, he says, you're never going to believe this. Look what we got. I said, what's the matter with you? Get up there. He said, no. Have a look. I looked, it was full of aerial bombs, shells and crates of ammunition. Check the next truck, there was no point. It was an ammunition wagon. The whole lot was an ammunition train. We shot out the other side. I could hear firing going across there. It was hazy. I could see for some 250, maybe 300 yards, but there I could see a road, hedgerows. I could hear Bren guns firing from down that area, and up on this area I could hear a couple of MG-42s clattering away. I said, right, we go that way, spread out. We'd made, and don't forget this time, we were wearing red berets. We must have been sticking out like bloody poppies. I think we made about 50 yards when, from over on our right, there was a shout of help, help, and stop it, hold it. And coming out of the murk sort of thing, don't get me wrong, you could see 75 to 100 yards clearly, maybe a bit more, according to where it was, you know, this mess was hanging about. There's this fella came running, he had no uniform, it appeared to be no equipment, no helmet, and he's got both hands up. And he's shouting, help me, I'm an American citizen. So I said, cover him. We knelt down, and he came galloping up, and he said, oh my God, 6th Airborne Division. You know that bloody Yankee voice. I said, yeah, that's right. I said, look, mate, you're way off. You're about 3 miles off course. Your outfit's over there somewhere, 3-4 miles away. He said, I'm not supposed to be here. So I just looked at him, and Billy Gray, God bless him, he started to laugh, and he's a bloke that still does. He laughs with his body, his shoulders. He said, don't look now, mate, we've got the same idea. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Who are you? He said, I'm a war correspondent. He said, I'm in the Dakota up there. I'm reporting this battle. I came over with American Paras. I'm recording the battle from the air. He's just doing his recording. There's a terrible bang, and the pilot says, "Bail out." And he bailed out with a notebook and pen. And that was it. He landed right among us. He looked at me, and it's just like that thing from outer space. "Take me to your commanding officer." I said, "Yeah, that's a good idea, mate." I said, "Where is he?" He said, "Well, don't you know?" I said, "No, I don't damn well know. Take me to your company commander." I said, "Look, mate, I don't even know where my bleeding platoon commander is. Can't you see what's going on here?" He said, "Oh, my God." Now, if that bloke said, "Oh, my God," once, he said it 50 times in the next three quarters of an hour. "Oh, my God." I said, "Look, mate, stay with us. We'll do what we can for you, all right?" He said, "Billy, you got a spare?" We always carried a couple of spares, so I wasn't going to give him mine. A spare revolver. So Billy gave me a Luger that he picked up in Normandy. It was his favourite Luger. So I turned to the Yank and I says, "Here, cop hold of this. Do you know how to use it?" He looked at me and said, "I can't use this." I said, "Well, you'll soon learn." He says, "No, I'm a civilian. If they catch me with this, they're going to shoot me." I said, "Look, mate, they're going to fucking shoot you anyway. So you might just as well have a go with it." He said, "But I'm a civilian." And he turned round. He had a bottle green jacket and slacks on. That's the only way I can describe it. And over here, in yellow, was a little arc thing with four or five initials on it. Now, I never did find out what they meant, but I think it meant it was a civilian war correspondent or some damn thing. I said, "Right, stay close to me. Spread out, let's go." Now, when I said stay close to me, I didn't ask him to hold my bleeding hand. But as we dashed this next 250 yards to this edge, I have never seen a bloke look in so many different directions at the same time. His head was on a bleeding swivel. It was an unmade road. Nothing on this side, just fields. That side, there was trees and hedges. Right, in the ditch, take stock. Bren guns going down there. Two MGs going over there, rifle fire. Right, let's spread out. I'd already picked my place. There was a large tree here. That'd do me nice. My sight, I already have my telescopic sight fitted on my rifle. I've got that ready. So I spread them out along the ditch, all right? And I put Billy Gray down there with his number two. "Get up on the bank, take him on." "Yeah. I'm getting up here." So I dashed up there and got myself behind this side of the tree, telescopic sight, and started. But just before I left, all of a sudden, a reporter in this American came to life. And I said, "What is it? What do you want now, for Christ's sake?" And he said, "My God, what a story I'm going to be able to tell when I get back." And Billy Gray was getting his Bren gun up. He turned around and said, "Oi, mate," he said, "don't you mean if you get back?" I said, "Oh, my God." I left him. I went up there and started hammering away. I think we'd been going about 10 minutes solid, you know, and it was really going great. And we were beginning to knock them down over there. And the Bren gunners, the two Bren gunners and whoever was down there, knew they had some help. All of a sudden, the Bren gunner got quiet. I suppose I was 40 yards up the road. So, "Billy! Billy!" I thought, "Oh, Jesus Christ, no, not Billy. Gray!" There's no answer. I thought, shit. I got out of the ditch, doubled over with my rifle, trotted down. The Bren gun was on top of the bank. Billy Gray was propped on one arm in the ditch with his number two. And there was this bleeding war correspondent. And Billy was saying, "And my mum and dad live at number such, and my girlfriend's name is so-and-so, and I'm going to get married." I just looked at him and I said, "I don't fucking believe this. What the hell do you think you're doing?" He says, "Corpse." Now, Billy called me Wally, on parade corporal, but if he had a threatening attitude, he called me Corpse, because that was what he was going to term me. And he said, "Corpse, I'm being interviewed." I said, "Get up on that. Now, this is a truth. You're going to phone this man from my house here tonight. He's in Northampton." "It's I'm being interviewed." I said, "I don't give a bugger with you. Get up on that." "That's for you. Another word out of you, and I'll bleed and screw you up, you bastard. Leave him alone." Open the bank. Gets back up there. I'm there about 5 minutes. And scurry. There's a Yank. "Where do you come?" "I come from London." "Excuse me." Bang. "Are you? Yeah, I'm married. I've got a wife and two kids. All right, my wife's name's Irene. Now, do you excuse me a minute?" "Well, come to finish," says, "now look, I don't want another bleeding word out of you, mate. I don't believe you." So he said, hang about. He said, get hold of it. I said, what's that? He said, it's my name, address, and the newspaper I work for. Keep in touch with me after the war. So I said, yeah, all right. And I put it in my pocket. And just then, coming up the road was about six blokes from the other platoon. Now, by this time, they'd quietened down, the Germans. I think they'd had enough. So they came up. Said, where's regimental headquarters? Where's regimental aid post? I said, you've got to go that way, mate. They had a bloke on a stretcher and some walking wounded. Hey, I said, you can do me a favour, could you? Take this bleeding Yank with you. I said, off you go, Yank. I'll see you about. That's the last I ever saw the man. They quietened down after that, and Billy Gray, I gave him a shout, and the rest, and they came up and joined me. I said, right, let's try and find Company HQ or some bloody thing or the other. We spread out and was going up the road, and Billy said, where's the Yank? I said, he's gone. He says, where's my Luger? Oh, I said, he took it with him. He said, the feeding bastard. I'll find it. That's my Luger. He never did find him. We got back to Company headquarters. There was burning glider still going on. There was wounded everywhere. I won't go into the full details of that particular day, but it was the second longest day of my life. We battled on all day. At half past 10 that night, I had a patrol out on the left, and Germans started moving tanks. And you only move tanks at night if you're desperate. I'd lost contact with everybody else. I left the section there in charge of Lance Corporal. I think it was Peckwood, I'm not sure. I was going out left. I couldn't find anybody. I'd come back. I said, I'm going right. I went right. Looming up out of the darkness, I said, who's that? Oh, he said, it's you. He said, where the bleeding hell you been? It was Bill Bailey. I said, I'm glad somebody else is here. I said, where the hell are you? He said, I've got a section on the right. I said, well, who else is here? He said, nobody. I said, for Christ's sake, what's happening? He said, they must have dropped back. And just then, there was the most gorgeous explosion behind me. And I flew forward into Bailey's arms. He caught me. He looked at me, and it was the fatal words. I've used them myself. Are you all right, mate? No, I ain't. Both legs. He said, all right, I'll get you in this building. There's a building behind us. We'd used it as company headquarters previous, but they'd gone back from there. He dragged me in there. There was a fellow by the name of Cook who was a medical orderly come radio man. There were two wounded Germans, one bloke who'd been blinded with bandages, and two other blokes laying on stretchers. Whether they were alive or dead, I don't know. But there's also smoke coming from everywhere. Bailey disappeared. I said, open that door over there. It was coming through the ceiling. It was a barn attached full of hay, and it was burning. The whole bloody place was on fire. I got hold of Cook. I said, get him on the radio. He managed to raise him on the radio. He started the usual performance. Abel Baker. I said, sod the Abel Baker. Give us it. I said, get your asses back here and get us out of here. There's six wounded in here and we've got to get out. It's burning. 5 minutes later, the door burst open. Billy Gray came in, the rest of us, and carted us back. They got us just across the Weser. I was laid down. I couldn't walk.
The Weser?
Not the Weser. It's a small river. Runs past Hemelke and in between Hemelke and Ringenberg. Yes, I think it's the Weser. The Elbe? No, the Weser's further up. The Elbe and the Weser. I'll get the name of this, a small one. It's a very small river, hardly anything at all. But there's a bridge over it further down. I'll get the name of it later on.
But you've been hit yourself?
Oh yeah, I had it in both legs. They laid me out on the deck there, and there was all. And then a couple of them tried to take me back to the RAP. They picked me up in a stretcher, got so far across a plough field, and I said, "Leave it, put me down. I'm not trying to stand."